Future Generations,
an IAS podcast.
Welcome to the Future Generations podcast. I'm Tessa Rotebaum, professor of early development and health at the University of Amsterdam. I am a biologist and I'm fascinated by the wonder of life. And I've studied for the past 25 years how human beings become who they are and how they're shaped by the early environment. I'm really excited to host this podcast and talk to experts about how what we do today is shaping future generations. And today I'm here with Dr. Laura Burgers. She's an assistant professor of law at the University of Amsterdam to talk about intergenerational solidarity. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to have you here. And I want to talk to you because your approach on how we think about future generations and how we are shaping the world that future generations will live in from a legal perspective is very exciting and really new to me. As a biologist, I know very little about law. So I really look forward to talking to you, to learning from you from the legal perspective. But before we start talking about your work, I'm really interested in you as a person. How did you get interested in law? So could you tell us a little bit more about how you got where you are today?
Well, I was interested in law from a very early age onwards. I read as a child this book called Verhalen van de Tweelingbroers of by Tonke Dracht. Well, we can translate that title, I think, as Stories of the Twin Brothers. And in that book, one of the twin brothers knows very early on what he wants to be. He wants to be a goldsmith. But the other one is searching for his goal in life for a very long time. And at some point, he becomes a thief. But then he realizes he's too much of an honest person for that. And at the very end of the book, he knows what he wants to be, namely a lawyer. So that is when I thought, oh, yeah, I also want to be a lawyer. So I already knew that I wanted to study law maybe from when I was 10 or 11 or so.
Wow, that's really interesting. And that really meant that from a very early age, you were interested in becoming a lawyer.
That's right. Yeah. So many people study law because they don't know what else to do. But for me, it was really my purpose for a very long time.
Excellent. And as I already said, to me, law is not something I know very much about. So in very, very general terms, what is the law actually trying to protect, or who is the law trying to protect?
Well, the law protects anyone that we want it to protect. So one thing that's important, I think, to realize about the law is that it's not something static. It's not something out there. Contrary to many exact scientists, lawyers do not study a natural phenomenon. No, they study something that is made by humans and also designed by humans. So we can really shape the law in whatever way we want. So it can protect all kinds of things, all kinds of interests of humans, of the natural world, of businesses.
Wow. So we'll talk a lot about that soon. Initially, I want to start talking about whether or not the law protects people who are currently alive today, or is there any basis for protecting people who are not yet here?
Yeah, that's one of the themes in my own research that I'm also totally fascinated by. So in general, most law protects those who are already here, but there are quite a bit of references to future generations, meaning the unborn, in all kinds of legal documents. So for instance, in the treaties that established the European Union, there is a reference to future generations. But also the very definition of sustainable development, which is, of course, one of the key principles, I would say, of not only international, but also national environmental law. The definition of sustainable development is development that meets the needs of the present generations without harming the needs of the future generations. So future generations are really part and parcel of that very definition.
Interesting. And would you say that this protection of future generations in legal documents and in treaties is increasing, or has that always been the case, that these treaties included future generations?
Well, yeah, I think that you can indeed say that is increasing. These treaties have not always been there. So future generations are mostly present in all kinds of documents about environmental issues. And in general, international environmental law started to develop mostly since the 70s. There were some treaties before that, for instance, on migratory species, already at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. But really since the 70s, there is a lot of international environmental law. So since then, we also see more references to future generations.
Right. And if you say environmental law, does that also mean that not only human beings, current and future ones, are protected by such laws, but that nature could also have legal rights?
Well, there is actually two questions in there. So one of them is whether nature is protected. And yes, of course, the whole purpose of environmental law is to protect nature. The other question is whether nature also has rights. And that is a way more difficult issue. And the same actually applies to future generations. So future generations are mentioned in quite a number of documents, but that does not immediately imply that they also have rights. So that is perhaps something that's a bit difficult for the non-lawyers. In a way, when something is protected, we humans have a duty to protect that, but that does not equal to that person or object having also rights. So you and me, we have rights. We are subjects of the law, legal persons, and legal persons have rights. For the law, there's also objects, like, for instance, nature. Water can be a product that you can sell. Same like land. You can own land that can be your property. A legal person can never be someone's property. So, for instance, when slavery ended, those who were enslaved were transformed, at least legally speaking, from objects of property into legal persons with their own rights. So, mostly, future generations and nature do not have rights. There is an increasing number of countries where nature is recognized as a legal person and as a rights holder. Yeah, and sometimes I think there's also entries in the law that can say that also future generations have rights, but I do not know of any example where someone really said that future generations are a legal person. But that's also a bit difficult, of course, because future generations is not one person. It will be an endless number of persons. So
exactly. Really interesting. So I hadn't realized I'm learning something new here. So what does protection actually mean if you say that there is a difference between having rights and we need to protect nature? Or could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think protection as such is not per se a legal term. So I do think that by giving or recognizing the rights of an entity, you would also probably give it some protection. To just give you an example from environmental law, say you want to start a mining project somewhere, then usually the international or national environmental law says you have to make an environmental impact assessment. So that is a procedural obligation. That means you have to map all the risks for the environment of your mining project. And once you have concluded that in a correct fashion, you can go on and execute the project. So that is a rather weak kind of protection. Of course, it does something because it makes people aware of the environmental risks of certain projects, and it makes these risks transparent. So perhaps then people can act upon those risks. But it does not say environmental impact assessment as an obligation, does not say as such that mining projects cannot go through. Now, crucially, this would be different, or it has proven to be different when nature also has rights. So in Ecuador, since 2008, rights are in the constitution. And since then, a whole set of case law has been developing. And in recent cases, judges also said, okay, even if the environmental impact assessment is executed in totally in a correct fashion, then still this mining project cannot go through because nature also has rights. So apart from a procedural test, there's also a substantive test on whether the rights are violated.
Right, right. I think many people will know about the Urgenda case.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be something similar? Could you talk about the case that actually led to this decision?
Of course. Rights of nature did not play a role in the Urgenda case. So that is good to note. The Urgenda case is a Dutch case about mm-hmm. climate change. It was launched by an NGO called Urgenda, hence the name. And Urgenda is short for Urgent Agenda. And what happened in this case was that, well, to summarize it very quickly, that Urgenda said the Dutch state should do more about climate change. It should have a more ambitious greenhouse gas emission reduction target. And the judges actually on three instances, court, the first instance, Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court all agreed with Urgenda. So it was kind of a groundbreaking case because, well, a government was ordered to set a specific emission reduction target. And for many, that was a bit controversial.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, it also has become less and less controversial.
And you said this was not about the rights of nature?
No, this is more about human rights. And that's actually also a rather recent development that's important. So for a very long time, environmental law and human rights law were seen as two totally separate domains until very recently. So I think it was only in 2018 or 2019 that I got an email by someone working for Amnesty International asking me, Laura, what do you think? Should we as Amnesty International also look into environmental issues now? Because for them, human rights were, well, and classically speaking, human rights are way more about issues like freedom of speech, all kinds of things. You can freedom not to be tortured, all these kinds of things. But there has been an increasing recognition that actually our human rights can also be violated due to all kinds of environmental issues.
Yeah, it's interesting. For me as a biologist, that makes so much sense that human beings are living creatures and they're sensitive to the environment. So environmental law and human rights can't be completely separate because human beings are affected and shaped by the environment.
Yes, and I also think that makes total sense. But so human rights are meant to protect us against the state, all kinds of state action. So you also have to make the connection between state action and the environment. And for a very long time, this whole thought that we are so much interconnected with the world around us was not very common. So nature was seen as something out there, separate from us humans. So the state can violate our human rights by not allowing us to vote, but that the state can violate our human rights by not protecting nature enough. That is quite a leap, at least it was. So actually, a few years ago, also the Human Rights Council of the United Nations recognized a right to a healthy environment. About 2/3 of states worldwide now also have a right to a healthy environment or a clean environment in their constitution. And increasingly, we also see that in these existing human rights, like the right to life or the right to have a safe home, are interpreted such to include environmental protection.
Really interesting. And I think there's an interesting parallel between the legal realization that these might be linked and the much more biological or biomedical realization that the two are linked.
Absolutely. I think law in general always follows general insights in society. Law is a very slow mechanism, but it follows upon all kinds of insights also, of course, from science.
Yeah. And when we talked about potential protection of the rights of future generations, you were talking about, there's a lot of progression in legal court cases showing that the rights of nature or the rights of future generations are explored. You recently spoke about an example from Pakistan, I believe. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, but I would also like to tell you a little bit more about your agenda case, because you asked me about that before. So I want to say two things. Firstly, there are many proposals by philosophers who say we should include future generations more into our legal system, especially when we think of climate change. We are not undertaking enough action against this. But this would probably be different if we would include the interests and rights of future generations more prominently in our decision making. So there are all kinds of philosophical proposals to, for instance, install a third house of parliament where representatives of future generations would take place, who then can veto all kinds of laws. Now, as you may imagine, this is hard to realize. There are some institutions for future generations in some countries. In the Netherlands, there are not. But, and this is so interesting, the NGO Urgenda said that it's not only represented, well, the currently living Dutch people, but also future generations. And the court actually accepted this claim. So it accepted that Urgenda had standing on behalf of future generations. And that makes the Dutch judge, as of this moment in the Netherlands, the only official institution where future generations can be represented.
And it's really fascinating.
It is fascinating. Now, what's also interesting is that on appeal, this was challenged by the state. They said it didn't make sense to represent future generations and that into infinity, they added. But the court actually did not find it relevant to deal with that argument. And that is also perhaps a little bit hard to understand for non-lawyers. So the issue here was, does Urgenda have standing or not? So in essence, does it mean, can Urgenda actually make this claim? Or should the whole case be dismissed? So if you're not, you do not have standing. If you're not admissible, then your case cannot go through. But what the court on appeal said is that Urgenda had standing anyway to represent presently living people, because the impacts of climate change are already so heavy on presently living people. So it was not really necessary to consider whether Urgenda also had standing or not on behalf of future generations. So it said it was not really necessary to deal with that argument because Urgenda had standing anyway, which is a very sort of legal way to not sort of to circumvent, not engage with a specific argument. But that is in a way concerning because it also flags to us, of course, okay, climate change is actually progressing that fastly that indeed the presently living people's human rights, even only in the Netherlands, are already violated if the state does not do enough against climate change. Now, so that is one of the cases that triggered also my interest in future generations in legal cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's why that's a bit of my ambition also for the coming years to look into this more. I've looked so far mostly at cases within Europe, but I'm eager to also research cases outside Europe more. And in that context, I indeed, with the aid, by the way, of a student assistant, I should mention her, Eline Mensink, she did a sort of preliminary mapping research for me. And she found this wonderful Pakistani case where there was a very nice way also around this issue of future generations in a way. So under Pakistani law, as far as I know, future generations do not have rights. In some legal systems, for instance, the Norwegian legal system, rights of future generations are actually mentioned in the constitution.
Okay.
This is not the case in Pakistan. I actually didn't say to you, but the Urgenda case is an example of climate change litigation. And that is a quite, it's an interesting phenomenon. That is a name for cases that are brought to court about the question who is or who should be responsible for climate change. And there are many of these cases at the moment, more than 2,000, which is really quite a lot.
In the Netherlands alone?
No, worldwide. So there's many of these cases, more than 2,000 worldwide. And that is really an enormous number. Also, if you consider that there's something like 200 countries in the world. So this Pakistani case is a kind of unique case because it's not launched by an environmental NGO or by a victim of climate change. It is rather launched by a business entity against the Pakistani state, because the state of Pakistan designated a certain area to be a protected area. And that meant for this business, if I'm not mistaken, a cement factory, that it could not expand into that area. And they felt that that was, well, not lawful. So they launched this case. So the question for the judge is it lawful, yes or no, for the state to prevent this business from expanding into that area? And then a fascinating, really inspiring also in a way, reasoning follows, because the judge says, he actually makes a reference to a book that is not from Pakistan. He makes a reference to a book that you may know called The Good Ancestor.
I know it from Roman Krusnarik.
Yeah. Which is a really wonderful book, I think, for anyone interested in future generations. It's about how we can be a good ancestor. So the judge says that he also should be a good ancestor in ruling such cases. So he's not reasoning from the rights of the future generations. Rather, he's reasoning from a duty of himself, a presently living generation. And in doing so, he interprets the preamble of the Pakistani constitution, which mentions the name democracy. And he says that democracy is meaning, in fact, a climate democracy. And we should be totally aware of the impact of what we do now to the future generations. And therefore, indeed, he says it's lawful for the state of Pakistan to designate certain areas as protected, and the factory loses this case. So really interesting way of reasoning to include the interest of future generations in such a decision.
It's really inspiring, I think, and also interesting for me to hear that a judge, partly also based on reading this wonderful book about how to be a good ancestor, seems to shape how he reads the law, how he interprets the law, and can make a lawful case for being a good ancestor and looking at democracy as a way to include the impact of current decisions on the future in a way.
Yes, absolutely. And it's also a way. So law is always interpreted sort of in the light of our present understanding. So there you also can see how a judge is taking in insights that are out there in society.
And that's really beautiful, I think, because you just mentioned that philosophers are increasingly arguing for thinking about the impact of what we do on future generations. From a legal perspective, this is happening. From a democratic perspective, what we do affects those who can't vote yet. And also from biomedical or from the scientific biomedical research, we know that what we do now affects future generations because we are all shaped by the environment, and that happens from very early on in development. And actually, the egg that made you and me was there when our mothers were in our grandmother's womb. So that means that the generations who are not even conceived yet are already present physically. So it seems interesting to me that from all these different disciplines, we're moving towards this similar sort of ambition to include our responsibility towards future generations and to build intergenerational solidarity in a way. So United Nations is obviously also very aware of these developments and is preparing a declaration on future generations. What would you wish for it to be included in that declaration to really help us make progress in recognizing our responsibilities towards future generations?
Oh, wow. That's a difficult question. I do think that it's important, but probably this is already there on the agenda, to recognize that future generations' interests are not only implicated when we talk about environmental issues, but this is, of course, about way more. Also pension funds or all kinds of decisions. So I think it's interesting to see that future generations first, I believe, emerged in an environmental law context, but they should really be dragged out of that and be included in decision-making across a whole spectrum.
Right, so a much more holistic approach to recognizing the interests of future generations. Yeah, yeah. So to go back from this global big perspective, looking forward to the Declaration on Future Generations that will be formulated in September of this year during the Summit of the Future, can I bring it back to something much more personal? If we talk about intergenerational solidarity, it also means that we feel some connection with our past and the way our ancestors shaped the world in which we live, and realizing that the current situation isn't separate from the past and what we do is affecting the future. Do you have any sort of sense of how you see a connection between your past and maybe the beautiful book that you read as a child, and how that connects to your ambitions for the future?
Oh, absolutely. So both my grandparents met when they were in law school. So that might have been another inspiration that was a little bit less perhaps, that I was perhaps less conscious of as a child, but it definitely made me very ambitious to become a lawyer. And my grandfather was an official working for the Dutch government and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And he was for some time the president of a working group that actually in the end finally concluded the Convention Against Torture. So he was also a human rights specialist.
Really? That's really interesting.
Yeah. And he's one of my heroes. My grandparents both passed away, what's it now, almost 8 years ago, but I dream of them almost on a daily basis. Yeah, it's a bit crazy. I don't know why. It also it's not always like that, but for the past year, I've dreamt a lot about them. And yeah, they were amazing people, very much committed to the rule of law, to fairness, to justice. So they were both very... yeah, very inspiring for me. And I hope I can also pass that message on.
Beautiful. Thank you so, so much. Thank you, Laura, for taking the time to talk to me. I've learned a lot and we've gained some insights into how the rights of future generations are increasingly being recognized, and we are increasingly protecting the environment in which future generations are being shaped. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you all for listening. Thank you for joining us on this time travel journey to create intergenerational solidarity. I invite you to think about how your ancestors have shaped you to who you are today and what you might do to help shape future generations. Please reach out in case you would like to join our community, and don't forget to subscribe.